You know, there'd be a lot less violence in the world if everyone got a little more cardio. Hey, is that a bazooka? This is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I am your host, Dan Benamor. Today, we are talking about the 2006 film Southland Tales. The film stars Dwayne Johnson, Sean William Scott, Sarah Michelle Gellar, Mandy Moore, Justin Timberlake, Miranda Richardson, Wallace Shawn, Bai Ling, John Larroquette, and Kevin Smith. Richard Kelly wrote and directed this film. He also wrote and directed Donnie Darko. The film was produced on a budget of $17 million and grossed $374,000. The film famously had a disastrous screening of an early cut at Cannes, and it holds a 39% on Rotten Tomato. Quickly, before we get started, just know we are going to spoil the film. This is your spoiler alert. Also, a special programming note. I had a very nice listener voicemail from listener Joshua Bauman, who wanted to know my thoughts on Brawl in Cell Block 99. Josh, you had no way of knowing this, but I was actually the development executive assigned to that film before it got made, so I have a lot to say about it. So listen to the very end of the show after the music break at the end. I'm going to do a bonus segment, and I'm going to talk about, you know, how we tried to make that movie and then obviously how it got made in the end. And then another listener, Ginger, also wanted to know about Bone Tomahawk, which is very related. So both of you and anybody else interested, listen to that bonus section after the show. My guest today is my buddy Micho Ritare, who's we just confirmed that I've been saying his name right our entire friendship. That was a big relief for me. Micho is an excellent writer and director who, like me, also started as a development executive. In that capacity, he was responsible for the Sharknado films. He also worked on the sci-fi show Z Nation. More recently, Micho worked on a series of election ads that were incredibly compelling and got millions of views. He is a cool, smart dude, and I'm very appreciative of him coming on the show. Welcome, Micho.
Thanks for having me. Is it Dan?
You know what's hilarious? It actually is not Dan.
Really? What is it?
Yeah. My parents are Moroccans. They're both born in Morocco, right?
Yeah. And Sephardic, right?
They're Sephardic Jews and they're French Moroccans. So like when I had my sister on the show, she kept calling me Don, which is actually my name. That's what they meant to name me. But because they're French Moroccans, when they see D-A-N, they pronounce it Don. And so they basically accidentally named me Dan. So my whole life, my parents have been like, hey, your name's not Dan. And I'm like, we're in America. I'm going to tell people D-A-N. I'm going to say Don. I'm going to be like, people think I'm an asshole. So yeah.
It's funny you mentioned that because I'm half Rwandan and that's the origin of my name, sort of. But I finally visited in like 2010. And one of my uncles was telling me like, your name is spelled wrong. Like, what are you talking? And so the H in my name is not in the original Kinyarwanda. It's actually M-I-C-O. Huh. I learned too that my name is bastardized.
I think it's very appropriate. I think it's very appropriate that we are starting the show on a tangent because Southland Tales is an entire movie that is a tangent.
Yeah. It's impossible to talk about it. I listened to some of your other episodes and it's like, I don't understand this movie any more than the listener does. So if you're coming to find out the secret of this movie, you're not going to find it, at least for me. Maybe Don knows.
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk about, so I asked you what movie you want to do. You suggested a bunch of movies. One of them was Southland Tales. I was enthusiastic about it, but we also talked about doing Perfume. And I was worried that, like in my brain, I'm like, maybe you and I are the only two people on the planet who like this movie. So I put it to an Instagram poll to my audience and 50% of the audience picked Southland Tales. It was like neck and neck with Perfume. The only person who reacted negatively was my buddy and previous guest of the show, Nick Oleksy, who sent me audio text messages threatening me not to do this film. So I hope Nick is listening and he hears me calling him out because our love for Southland Tales will not be silenced.
That's right. You got to love, I think it's not unfair to call this a bad movie in the sense of it's not what you would normally consider a good movie.
I have written down here, it is a fair position if you don't like this film. And I think that a lot of the movies we do on the show, I'm arguing that like, hey, this is a great movie by any definition, but this is one where it's like, you kind of got to go in a certain way. I mean, I was a journalist and I think I went to the press screening for this movie and I remember people walking out of it. And I remember having to write a review of it and writing that basically it was a movie that kind of coasts along on this weird energy that you almost can't describe. And I think that's kind of the thing. I mean, I usually get the plot synopsis for the show. I'll get it from Wikipedia and then kind of supplement it. And when I went to Wikipedia for this, even the people of Wikipedia gave up. The plot synopsis is like a shrug. They're like, yeah, and then a bunch of stuff happens and that's the end. Like,
yeah, no, I couldn't. I know you usually walk through the plot, but I know that I couldn't walk through the plot of this movie. I have a hard time keeping it all in my brain at once.
We are going to very, very loosely walk through the plot. So the movie starts in 2005. We're at the most American barbecue in American history. There are American flags just out the ass in every corner of the frame. Then a nuke goes off. Justin Timberlake tells us, in the aftermath of nuclear attacks in Texas, America is on the brink of anarchy. World War III happens. There's all these on-screen graphics speeding us through world-building exposition. There's a graphic that indicates Republican control of the government, and that's immediately paired with a video of an elephant humping another elephant. Just really, and that video is sponsored by Bud Light and Hustler. This video about World War III. A minute and a half into this movie, you're already, as a viewer, you're like, what is this? What's going on? It's just sort of a mess, but it's like a glorious mess. And you can sense, I think, and I want to know what you think, like from the start, it's almost like Richard Kelly like has his fingers strapped to the steering wheel and he is just going and there's not going to be any stopping him.
Yeah, he's committed to his vision, which, you know, it's something like, I mean, if you ever read the Book of Revelation, it is also an incoherent jumble, but then the thing that's tantalizing about it is, as much as it's, I wouldn't necessarily call it a mess, although that's a fair characterization, it's striving for something. It's trying to capture a feeling, a mood, and it does succeed in terms of, like you said, the mood kind of pulls you along. So it's like one of the few, I would say, mood-driven films that kind of is packaged as a plot-driven film, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So America becomes so radicalized by the nukes that now the government has become repressive. We have Dwayne Johnson. He's called Boxer Santeros. He's a famous actor with ties to the Republican Party. He's disappeared. He's found in the desert. His memories are erased. We meet Justin Timberlake. He's Private Abilene. He's an actor turned soldier who was injured in Iraq. He has this weird goatee for some reason. JT, very good in Alpha Dog, which we also did on the show. He's the narrator. He says, this is the way the world ends. We get a title card, Chapter 4, which means we're starting the movie with Chapter 4. I want to just, because I think it's so relevant to this movie. What is your mileage on Donnie Darko? And then like the reason that this movie, he was able to kind of get away with all this is because Donnie Darko is a movie that's very easy to watch and be like, oh man, this is really fucking deep, bro. Like, it's like one of those movies. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, did that affect him going to make this movie? Meaning that, was there any chance he would have gotten to make this movie if he didn't make Donnie Darko first?
Yeah, I think there's no chance. And that's why I admire Richard Kelly so much. And I wish, one of my fantasies, actually, the first time I really thought about being a producer and not just a writer and director was my encounter with Richard Kelly's movies. And I just had this feeling like, here's a guy who has something to say.
Yeah.
He's trying to really, honestly, his ambition is to unveil the secrets of the universe. And that's not overstating it because, you know, there's a lot of physics, quantum physics, mumbo jumbo in all of his movies. But I don't even want to call it a tragedy because that's too diminishing of him. In Donnie Darko, he lands the plane, pun intended.
Yes.
You know, it does cohere the story, the explanation for what happens. It all kind of comes together at the end. And even though it's very trippy and even though it's very surreal, it does all sort of click and make sense by the end of the movie. And for me, and I think for him as well, and I think for a lot of filmmakers, there's something akin to death when you finish a movie or when you actually succeed in making it the way that it was intended to be.
Yeah.
And there's something unsatisfying about just simply landing the plane, simply pleasing the audience, simply having it make sense. And that's why I admire that his next, because he could have very easily gone a safer route, more commercial route, a more audience pleasing route. And that's why I admire that Southland Tales. It's really about the same thing as Donnie Darko, just on a much bigger canvas, much more ambitious.
It's so hard to describe. So we find out that The Rock and Sarah Michelle Gellar have written a screenplay that foretells the destruction of mankind. Wallace Shawn has created a new alternative energy source called Fluid Karma. His team of scientists is Bai Ling, Zelda Rubinstein from Poltergeist, and Booger from Revenge of the Nerds. This movie was cast by Mad Libs. Sarah Michelle Gellar is an ex-porn star. She hosts a talk show about important social issues like poverty, quantum teleportation, and teen horniness. A big plot point in the movie is that everyone is looking for The Rock. Like, The Rock has gone missing, and this is like the biggest deal in the whole government. And I thought it was funny to watch it now, because I think if The Rock went missing now, it would go to the highest levels of government. Like, it would be a national crisis. Do you think so?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I definitely think so. And it's amazing to see this movie today, after all we've been through over the last 15 years since this movie came out. And I felt it at the time. I'm not sure that I saw it in the theater, but I saw it pretty, because of course nobody did. It would have changed the box office if I had. But I saw it pretty shortly thereafter, and it had that feeling like this movie it's true. There's something true about the movie. And sure enough, you know, we had our celebrity president. We had our, you know, everything in this movie is kind of like foretells the present day. But yeah.
It's really the snake eating its tail. I mean, literally, this crazy movie where there's a screenplay that foretells the destruction of mankind actually was kind of prescient about a lot of things.
It's true. It's an Ouroboros in that way, where it's a movie within a movie within a movie. And I think that's what's so beautiful about it, is that it functions on so many levels metaphorically. Like, I can't remember if it's a wormhole, the interdimensional, whatever.
Yeah, whatever it is.
But that's a metaphor, a very on the nose metaphor for what the film is itself, which is, it's a work of prophecy. And of course it's self-referential in that way with the Book of Revelation and the two witnesses.
Yeah.
Which I couldn't begin to explain.
Yeah.
It really is. It's the closest allegory to the Book of Revelation, I think, on film.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if that was his sort of founding principle. So moving forward, Sherry O'Terry shows up with Christopher Lambert. Why not? We meet Sean William Scott, who is Ronald Taverner. His first line is, "There's a delay in my reflection." And, you know, this is something that was interesting watching this movie. I genuinely wonder, do I like this movie because I am a cinematic anarchist and I just really like movies that are just going for it and just don't care? Like, hey, you know, they're trying different things. Or do I actually like it as a movie, because you almost can't watch it as a regular movie? If you try to watch this movie as a regular movie, inevitably you're going to be unsatisfied by it.
Yep. Yeah. It's subversive. It's attacking the kind of Christian Republican. I wouldn't even say it's attacking so much as commenting on it. Maybe it's not as extreme to say it's attacking. It's attacking American culture. It's tearing down the form itself of filmmaking, certainly commercial filmmaking, and the personas of all the actors involved. It's sort of a surreal casting, like you said. I don't know that I would say that it's casting, because it's very 2000s-y. That's another thing that we could talk about, is that it's such a reflection of that time and place. I guess just that time, but yeah.
Yeah, to that point. So we have Sean William Scott, who is posing as his twin brother, a cop, which is part of this like plan of this fringe rebel group. He gets The Rock to do a ride along with him to research a role. He mentions that he hasn't had a bowel movement in 6 days. This leads to a debate between Wood Harris and Amy Poehler, who are also part of this like rebel group, about the biblical nature of taking shits. And then it's like they're pretending to be a couple having a domestic dispute, and they're screaming at each other. And one of the other people in the rebel group goes, "They're so good at improv." And it's another thing that kind of occurred to me in watching it is like, I think you have to watch this movie as a straight up comedy. Like, it is a comedy. And I think Richard Kelly thinks it's a comedy, but I'm not 100% sure of that. Do you think that he is in on the joke?
I'm not 100% sure either, because I found myself, I see it as a very serious movie, and I don't fully understand. I mean, the comedy in it is, it's hard to describe, but it's very like juvenile, very, I mean, there's like Proposition 69.
This thing with the car, I have to do like 10 seconds on it. So yeah. There's a car commercial where one car mounts another car and has sex with it. And then at the end of the commercial, the other car's hood pops open, which is meant to signal an orgasm. And then the commercial ends with "coming soon." It is. It's so funny. It's like what you're talking about, that duality, right? Like, it's, there's moments of it that feel very serious. But then there's also like Sarah Michelle Gellar has a music video where she sings "teen horniness is not a crime." And it almost, I was thinking to myself, like, is this Richard Kelly's version of Idiocracy?
That's a great comparison. I think it's a satire. That's what it is. It's not so much a comedy as a satire. It is his version of Idiocracy. And like Idiocracy, it's very prophetic. That's a great call.
So there's this scheme to stage a double murder by a racist cop that The Rock gets on film. The racist cop is played by John Lovitz, who looks like swole in this movie. I think John Lovitz did like a, some sort of like a training day. I think John Lovitz thought he was being in Training Day or something. Like, he got sort of like yoked to play this guy. He kills Wood Harris and Amy Poehler. We find out that they are working for Sherry O'Terry. There's all this sort of like complicated double crosses going on within the rebel group. We have Mandy Moore, who plays The Rock's wife. Low key, Mandy Moore, she is in this and American Dreams, which are both like underseen satires where she plays like super caustic characters. And she's really good in both of those movies. Like, I feel like there's like a whole acting career of Mandy Moore that we didn't see. She's the daughter of a senator. It's an election year. So The Rock sleeping with an ex-porn star is a scandal. Meanwhile, Wallace Shawn has a scheme for world domination. Christopher Lambert kidnaps Sean William Scott's twin. Justin Timberlake injects himself with fluid karma and does a hallucination musical number to the Killer's song, "All These Things That I've Done," which I've been singing to myself for the last 3 days since watching.
It's been in my head this whole time, yeah.
Like a lot of the weirder movies we've done on the show, you're either coming or you're not at that point. Like, if you're not on board for the hallucination musical number, you should just stop watching this movie. There's a throwaway line I also want to point out after that between two minor characters. It's like John Larroquette and I don't know the actress's name, but he tells her, "Have you ever lost anyone in a terrorist attack?" And she says, "Two of my four ex-husbands, they were on a fishing trip. They all used to take together to bitch about me."
Yeah.
That line is so good. It's so weird and specific and funny. And that to me is like this movie. Like, it's like in each individual scene, there's like a little moment like that that sort of keeps you in it moment to moment.
Yeah, it's very clever in unexpected places, right when you're kind of ready to say, this is just like a mess. It does kind of land, like bring it home and nail a moment like that before she tases him in the balls.
Yeah, then she tases him in the balls.
There's so much like butt humor, sex humor, like it's, and it's funny too, because I think the satire element and the Idiocracy element, it's very of that time. That's sort of when The Daily Show was born, and that kind of whole, it's almost an act of rage against the system, you know, as we were dragged into Iraq. And I remember too, watching this movie reminded me, like, Hummers, the cars kind of symbolized the Bush administration, Halliburton, the Iraq war. And of course, it's like, obviously a visual callback to the elephants fucking each other, the two cars mounting each other.
It's highbrow and lowbrow at the same time. Okay, we have to take a break for our sponsor. We're gonna be right back for more high level nonsense from this movie in one moment. Movies I Love That No One Talks About is brought to you by Virtual Pitch Fest. Virtual Pitch Fest is a trusted industry source that specializes in connecting screenwriters with production companies and representatives. With Virtual Pitch Fest, writers can search through an online database, almost like a dating site, to see what 500 plus participating companies are looking for. They can then send short written pitches on their scripts to chosen companies with the assurance of a guaranteed response back. That's right, guaranteed, you get an answer, you get a fair shot. That's a really critical difference with this service compared to some of the other online pitch services for writers. To date, site connections have led to 150 plus success stories, including produced films. There's actually a Bruce Willis, Megan Fox movie that was recently produced directly because of Virtual Pitch Fest. Just a writer who, you know, was relatively unknown, went on there, did a pitch. The pitch was picked up by a producer, and then that ended up becoming this movie. There's also been dozens of other script deals, many writers landing representation. If this sounds like something that could be useful to you, check out Virtual Pitch Fest at virtualpitchfest.com. Okay, we are back. So there's this government monitor character who's really great. Like, the whole thing with her is great. She works for the government's like Patriot Act surveillance company thing. And her job is to look at bathrooms all day. And like, her other coworkers are like, man, I'm really worried. I think her name is like Doris or something. I'm really worried about Doris. Like, she's been on like bathroom duty for like 24 hours straight. She's constantly eating Cheetos. She downloads The Rock's screenplay, and then she comes to believe that she's a character in the screenplay. So she goes and finds The Rock on the beach, and she tells him that he must board the Mega Zeppelin. All these secrets he's looking for, they're in the Mega Zeppelin. And he's just like, yeah. And then she says something about a dead body. There's this elaborate series of events involving the blackmail tape and the double murder. And then it leads to a scene where I had assumed that Justin Timberlake was this like lone paranoid sniper character, but I guess there's actually snipers on roofs everywhere in this future, because there's a big confrontation with John Lovitz and Sherry O'Terry, and this random other sniper shoots them. So that means, does that mean that there are snipers just all over the place on roofs in this future?
Yeah, it's a weird kind of setup to that concept. And then you only see that guy, I think, for that one scene.
Yeah.
I think they're guarding the, what's the name of the mysterious machine in the ocean?
The machine of perpetual motion or something.
Yeah, perpetual. Hold on. I think I wrote it down. It has something to do with particle entanglement.
Sure.
Which I don't understand. I never understood physics in the first place. So it's like, it all makes sense to me, but, yeah, I got the sense that this is part of the militarized regime of surveillance and, you know, pacification. That's another, you know, premonition, is the way that the discourse we have today around police violence. And then, of course, from the early 2010s with the NSA and Edward Snowden and all, this came before all of that.
Yeah.
And it's a big part of this movie. I also think in a way, you kind of feel it in Donnie Darko more than in this movie. The idea that he's this kid like sketching ideas and then reverse engineering a movie around them. There's something very iconic about Justin Timberlake with his sniper stand that's kind of, is it on top of a lifeguard tower?
It's on top of like a Mexican restaurant
it's not on top of a lifeguard tower. Yeah. It should have been on top of a lifeguard tower. No offense, Richard Kelly, you know what you're doing, but maybe you don't. But that's it's on the beach, and it's sort of the end of the world, the end of America, the end of the line, the end of the dream. The Hollywood comparison, like talking about the screenplay, is another current in this, the idea that LA is this place of apocalypse where dreams turn to nightmares, and it's got that kind of noir undercurrent as well.
Yeah, it's all over the place. The Rock gets kidnapped for no reason that I was aware of. He has a Jewish Star of David tattoo around his belly button, which I noticed on this viewing.
Yeah, I was trying to remember. I was trying to figure out which of those tattoos were his actual tattoos and which were from the movie. I didn't do a comparison.
I'm pretty confident that The Rock does not have a Star of David around his belly button. I think it would have been news if he did. So the Rock says the world is going to end. Everything is building to the launch of the Mega Zeppelin. The incriminating footage of The Rock gets released by Kevin Smith in heavy makeup as this fringe radical. This is, I'm sure, the only movie where Wallace Shawn and Bai Ling dance together in front of a giant American flag and then make out, like, tongues flapping. The Rock finds out his screenplay was prophetic, and Wallace Shawn's new energy source has caused a rift in space-time, and he's already gone through this rift, duplicated himself. They show him his past self. Sean William Scott was hired to drive The Rock into the rift, which is why there are two of him. He finds his duplicate, shakes his hand. It's this classic sci-fi idea of, like, if you meet yourself from a different dimension, is the universe going to implode or something? There is an extensive Rock Geller Moore dance number, which I'm very open to interpretation on. Lou Taylor Pucci shoots a rocket into the Zeppelin from a levitating ice cream truck, which contains the two Sean William Scotts, who are having a very emotional and actually very well acted scene amidst this lunacy. He forgives himself for a friendly fire incident in Fallujah. And there's something about being a new messiah, and then the movie's over.
Yeah.
Kelly was, like, really feeling himself when he made this movie. Again, we're not knocking it. We really, you know, think highly of Richard Kelly, but you can't, can you watch this movie and not think that?
No. No, you can't watch this movie. I don't know how many, if a triple negative, you can't watch this movie and not think that. Is that right?
Yeah.
You have to think it when you watch this movie. It's almost like, and it's in keeping with the apocalyptic mood and the apocalyptic themes of the movie. It's almost like he's saying, it's a movie he would make if he would never got to make another movie.
Yeah.
And that's also kind of an undercurrent in the style. It's like this manic kitchen sink of everything that he could possibly have ever wanted to do. And maybe I would suspect everyone who he would want to work with.
Yeah.
All kind of jammed into one movie. And that's what I admire about it, is he's not playing it safe. And maybe he was so full of himself that he didn't think he needed to play it safe, but I don't get that sense.
It's almost like if you've read, I think William Friedkin wrote a book and talked about this, like, he made this movie called Sorcerer, which has been reappraised and is considered a great movie. But at the time that he made it, Steve McQueen wanted to be in it. And Friedkin was so kind of high on his own ego after, I think it was after Exorcist and French Connection. It was after one of his big movies. And he says this pretty candidly in his book and has said it in interviews. It was a big career mistake not to let McQueen be in that movie. And instead, he went with a different cast. And I think that it had a lower profile cast, basically. And that probably contributed to it not being as successful. And, you know, it's like this is a very common thing in film history, is basically directors who have, like, a big hit and then they got some juice. And they're like, this is my juice movie. I'm going to do all this weird shit that I can get away with. And then some directors, that movie's great. And some directors, it's not necessarily great. You know, I think you think about Coppola and Apocalypse Now, right? Like, it's almost like, what if Richard Kelly made Apocalypse Now? It would probably be quite a bit weirder. This almost feels like his Apocalypse Now.
It does. And it's an interesting that you bring up that 70s generation of filmmakers, because I think in some ways Richard Kelly was sort of not born at the right time, you know, to quote the Paul Simon song. If he had been part of that generation, he probably would have had a similar arc as some of those filmmakers. And I think he must have been inspired by them. And it is, and I think Kevin Smith, there was an interview he did, I read something he said about Richard Kelly, that if he had just sort of gone the route of Christopher Nolan, he might have had more success. But there's something about that you know, auteur-driven approach to filmmaking that flourished in the 70s, that you have to go too far. You have to be lost in La Mancha at some point in your career. And that's part of the process, part of the what it takes to be a great director. And I think we might have lost that somewhere along the way. I don't know.
Yeah, you think about the Werner Herzog documentary, I think it's called Burden of Dreams, where it's like him and he's in the jungle and he's trying to make, I think it's Fitzcarraldo.
Fitzcarraldo, yeah.
And they need to haul this boat over this hill. And, like, it's the central set piece of the movie. He has to have that part of the movie. And so he's trying to, but the problem is I think in the story, it's like almost an impossible feat, but then in reality, in real life, it was almost an impossible feat.
Yeah.
In the documentary, Werner Herzog is talking to, it's like these indigenous people where he's filming that are going to have to actually do this. And it's like the first engineer quits and he thinks that Werner is going to get somebody killed. Yeah. And then they try to do it and it fails and like a cable snaps and you see a guy just like bloodied. And I think at one point in that movie, if I'm remembering correctly, Werner is like, yeah, you know, so I'm here in the jungle and pretty much I have like a prostitute. And, I kind of thought it would be a little weird, but I don't know. It sort of feels normal now. And like you sort of sense that Werner is just losing his mind in the jungle trying to make this movie. And, there's different filmmakers where like that process can lead to something that is really great and really coherent. And there's some filmmakers where it's like, it's really great, but it's not necessarily coherent. And I think this movie is a movie that is great, but not coherent.
That is a true statement. And I think that there is something, you know, the auteur theory and that idea of the heart of darkness trope of filmmaking, of just, you know, going for broke, who cares if some of the natives die, that, you know, and I'm not even saying that glibly. Like in that same William Friedkin book, he talks about when they were making The French Connection and the chase that they do.
Yeah.
It involved bribing an official, and the bribe was like he got to retire in the Bahamas in exchange for allowing them to do this thing. But when you really stop and think about that, he's putting people's safety in jeopardy.
Yeah, he talks pretty candidly about it. I think I remember what you're talking about. And I think he basically says, like, listen, I probably, you know, could have gotten some people killed. Like, I wouldn't have done it now.
It's
probably the reason it's the best car chase in movie history. So, you know, how do you sort of weigh that out?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, from this perspective, from our enlightened perspective in 2021, I think, you know, just as an empathetic human being, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, we're talking about making movies here. We're not talking about saving the world, you know, and I guess to the extent that we are saving the world, maybe it is worth it, right? Like that's the question.
I think it's also a younger person's perspective. And I think this is sort of what Friedkin is talking about in his book. And, you know, maybe Michael Bay, when he's like in his 70s, will look back at some of the things he's done. Because Michael Bay, if you watch any of the behind the scenes of any Michael Bay movie, it's always like, yeah, this was super dangerous. I think when you're younger, you sort of think of making a great movie as the most important thing in the world. And then as you get older, you're like, man, that's crazy. Who cares? It's just a movie.
Yeah, it's a tough one, because when you give up on that making a movie is the most important thing in the world, are you giving up on some level? Have you lost your juice? I mean, I didn't really look into it, but what happened to Richard Kelly? Like, did you research that?
What's hilarious is on the Wikipedia page, there's some link to some article where Richard Kelly's like, yeah, you know, we're going to make a Southland Tales sequel or series for a streamer or something. And I'm like, who's going to finance that? I think Richard Kelly is a fascinating dude. I think that if they can figure out a way to sort of like, I think it's interesting what you said at the beginning of the show about like producing, right? It's almost like we got to find Richard Kelly, a producer who could just sort of be like, just right here, just like move this like an inch that way. And this will all just kind of line up and it'll be a lot more accessible to a wider audience because, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt he's like a super talented dude.
Yeah. Let's do it. Let's produce him.
Let's Richard Kelly, where you
at? You're listening.
I want to, just before we end, I want to just do 2 minutes on how hype works in our business, because you and I understand that.
Yeah.
And I
think, maybe you do. I wish, I'm still learning, but yeah.
I think it's very relevant to this movie because Hollywood, and specifically like within the business of Hollywood, meaning agencies and production companies and stuff, everyone is terrified to have an original opinion and is equally terrified to admit that they don't understand something. So Richard Kelly makes Donnie Darko, right? Is this super well-received movie, not a giant hit, but it's very widely acknowledged as being a great movie. And then there's this sort of aura around him, which is like, this guy is a genius. You don't even understand like how deep this dude is, whatever. Then he comes up with an even weirder movie, Southland Tales. And I would be willing to bet that as this script is generated and is passed around the agencies and his agent is helping package it or whatever, it is hyped as this is the coolest thing ever. This movie is going to change the world, blah, 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 blah. And only when it finally premieres at Cannes, and in Cannes, they don't care. They boo movies all the time. Like they hated the rough cut. Then suddenly everybody turns on the movie, and then it almost goes the other way. People are sort of unfairly harsh on the movie. I just want to get a sense of like, what was your feeling on how this movie was probably made, meaning how it was packaged, how it was produced, how it was financed, and then ultimately the reaction to it?
Yeah, I mean, having not researched it, you know, exactly how it came together, I do suspect, and I guess there's three phrases I have to describe this phenomenon. One is not my phrase, the emperor is wearing no clothes. That's the obvious one. My phrase is, I call it M. Night Shyamalan disease, where, you know, where it's like you have an amazing, you know, rookie film and a young filmmaker. And then that's just sort of like the aura, like you said, like, well, maybe this thing that I don't understand is actually a genius, you know, like that kind of syndrome. And then the other cousin of that syndrome is the Avatar papyrus syndrome. Like, you know, when watching Avatar, it's like this gajillion dollar movie, and the font is papyrus. And it's a ridiculous, like, and that's a separate phenomenon. That's when you have a powerful filmmaker who's too powerful and kind of shuts down. And I don't know the process. I don't know how James Cameron did it, but somebody should have vetoed the papyrus font at some point along the way. And the fact that it didn't happen, it's such an interesting phenomenon, the way that, you know, I'm sure that's what happened, that people said, yeah, this is amazing. Oh, yeah, it's like
my big, it's brilliant. My big thing on that is unobtainium. Like, remember in Avatar?
Yeah.
Called unobtainium. Yeah. And it's like, it's just one of those things where, like, when you become really powerful, and I completely empathize with this because I'm sure that I hate rewriting scripts. Writing scripts sucks, but you have to do it when you're not as powerful. When you get more powerful, you don't necessarily have to do it. And it's like, you just need that guy that or girl that's on your team that just tells you, like, yo, maybe we shouldn't call the unobtainable mineral unobtainium. Don't you think that's a little on the nose?
Yeah, it's a lesson I've learned in my small way as well, where the only thing worse than getting notes is not getting notes.
Yeah.
And like, you need to have that pushback and that sense of, what are we doing here? You know, is this really clicking? Is this making sense? And even if it's not making sense, is it not making sense in the right way? And I think that'd be one objective, to the extent there can be an objective criticism of Southland Tales, is just like, it's hard to watch. It's hard to follow. As you were going through the synopsis, I was like, oh, that's what was happening. You know, and I've seen it multiple times. I still don't understand, like, the plot in particular. And it's a bit of a bait and switch. I mean, I don't blame people for walking out, because most people, what you're paying for is you're paying for a story. And if the story isn't easy to understand or doesn't flow, you've been swindled on some level.
Yeah, I think it actually connects to Cameron back in the sense that, you think about Avatar, right? There's things that are in Avatar, like the unobtainium, that, like, for us as people that really are very precious about writing, I think we sort of like chafe at. But Avatar is, without question, there is something that is universally powerful in the storytelling of Avatar, right? Obviously, for it to make $2 billion, people go back and back again to watch it. There's something that is universal. This movie is like the polar opposite of that. It's not universal. It's not something that anybody can watch from any culture and appreciate. It doesn't have that universal story stuff that we've come to sort of like connect to the form. But in the same time, that's sort of why we like it, because it is so different and not what you're expecting. And it kind of challenges you. So yeah, Southland Tales.
It has the camp. I mean, there's something to be said for camp as our cult films. You can make them your own. I mean, a movie like Avatar, it speaks for itself. It doesn't rely on interpretation. It doesn't need an ambassador. But I think part of the reason why I wanted to talk about Southland Tales is that it needs explanation. It needs exegesis. It needs somebody to say, these are the dots that I connected. What are the dots that you connected? And in a way, that's a richer experience than the kind of mass media, universally understood and explicable thing. Because if I had to put in a time capsule, you know, to my great-great-grandchildren, show me one, you know, I'm going to spend 2.5 hours and teach me about what it was like to live in 2005. I would give them this movie, you know, because it's so specific, and yet it does transcend itself in the sense that it is about a feeling, and a feeling that you can still have no matter what year it is, no matter what, you know, time it is.
All right. Well, that is our show for this week. If you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group at Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at the same. If you dig the show, please leave me a 5-star review on iTunes. It's a big help to the show. And if you're a monthly supporter of the show, feel free to request an episode at any time, including Joshua Bauman, who is now supporting the show, and listen in for your bonus segment after the music break. I want to thank my guest, Micho. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, bonus segment. Here we go. So this is for listener Joshua Bauman. Please find me, by the way, on Facebook or Instagram and request an episode since you're a supporter of the show. Let's talk about Brawl in Cell Block 99. So that was written by a guy named S. Craig Zahler. I was actually able to go back and see the coverage of the script I wrote when I was an intern. And I said that the violence grows wearisome because the script's escalation is redundant. And I said, I wonder how much patience an audience would have for seeing this man be beaten and abused before it becomes dull. Now, you might think I was an idiot, and I very well may be, but later I became a development executive and I read a ton of coverages we had done on this script, and pretty much every coverage had the exact same notes. The special sauce of this was Zahler, and it's something I've talked about on the show a lot. The difference between a script and a filmmaker, where basically, you know, you're writing that script and there's a filmmaker with a vision who gets to execute it, and, you know, especially if those are the same person, is that they can kind of bring it to life in a way that wouldn't be obvious necessarily from the script. The movie is fun. The script is very grim, but the movie is fun. And if I remember right, they had this kind of soul music soundtrack, which added a lot to it. And, you know, Zahler, he just knew what he knew what movie he wanted to make, and his filmmaking is what makes it good. I think if it was any other director, it would not have been as good. Zahler had wrote that movie for Steve Austin, who ended up not doing it for some reason. And then we offered it to a ton of actors. I mean, I personally was involved in offering it to Dominic Purcell, Kellan Lutz, a lot of actors who were sort of on that level who passed. I remember talking to Tim Olyphant's manager about it, and he said that he kind of wished it had more humor. And the thing is, it does have humor. It's just more obvious in the filmmaking, and it's not as obvious in the script, where the script is just feels like almost oppressively grim. The only reason that movie ended up getting made, like, we ultimately were not really able to put it together because we kept having actors pass on it. And then what happened is that this guy, his name is Dallas Saunier, who is Zahler's producer, was his manager. He personally put up his house to finance Bone Tomahawk. So Bone Tomahawk, again, a script that was brought to us, and it was like a cannibal Western, and it's sort of like, man, who's going to finance this? But Dallas had put together a really strong cast, including Kurt Russell. And then he was at risk of losing Kurt Russell, and he took this leap of faith, put up his house, helped finance the movie. They make Bone Tomahawk. Bone Tomahawk turns out great. That establishes Zahler as a director. And then that gets Vince Vaughn to agree to do Brawl. And that's how Brawl gets made. You know, at the time when we were doing it, Zahler wasn't attached to direct. It was something where basically we were going to have our own director direct his script. And then he does Bone Tomahawk, and then he directs Brawl. And I think it's great that he directed Brawl. I think he was the best director for his own script. And then Vince Vaughn actually ends up convincing Mel Gibson to do Dragged Across Concrete, which is Zahler's next film. So I like Brawl. I think it's a really interesting case where I could literally probably show you 100 coverages of the script that all have the same notes and are all relatively negative. But then when Zahler makes the movie works. And if he had taken the notes that are from the script, the movie would not have been as good. So that does happen sometimes, where, like, you can have something on the page and everyone gives you the same note, but that note is basically wrong. And you know that as a filmmaker. And it's just, some people are idiosyncratic filmmakers and they have to be able to just go do their thing. Both these movies are good, Bone Tomahawk and Brawl, and they probably would only be as good as they are, if Zahler made them. So that's what I think about those two movies, and that was my, you know, very tertiary role in the path before they eventually were made. There you go. Thanks.